cooking, simple carpentry, bicycle repair, yard work. I'm useless when it comes to abstract mathematical thought. Mental games like chess and puzzles are just too taxing for my simple brain. We sat down at the table and began to eat. A carefree lunch on a sunny Sunday afternoon in autumn. And Choco was a perfect lunchtime companion. She was gracious and witty, full of things to talk about, and with a great sense of humor. Her table manners were elegant, yet there was nothing pretentious about her. I could tell she came from a good family and had attended the most expensive schools. Maria left all the talking to her aunt and concentrated on her meal. Later, Choco asked for my recipe for the sauce. We had almost finished our lunch when the front doorbell gave a cheerful ring. It was no surprise to me, for just a moment earlier I thought I had heard the deep purr of a Jaguar engine. That sound, the polar opposite of the whisper of the Toyota Prius, had registered in that narrow layer between my conscious and unconscious minds. So it was hardly a bolt from the blue when the bell chimed. "Excuse me for a second," I said, rising from my chair and putting my napkin down. Leaving the two of them at the table, I went to the front door. What would happen now? I didn't have a clue. Chapter 34. Couldn't recall the last time I checked my tire's air pressure. I opened the door, and there stood Manshiki. He was wearing a white button-down shirt, a fancy wool vest with an intricate pattern, and a bluish-gray tweed jacket. His chinos were a light mustard color, his suede shoes brown. A coordinated and comfortable outfit, as always. His white hair glowed in the autumn sun. The silver Jaguar was behind him, parked next to the blue Toyota Prius. Side by side, the two cars resembled someone with crooked teeth, laughing with his mouth wide open. I gestured for him to enter. He was so tense, his face looked frozen, like a plastered wall, only half dry. Needless to say, I had never seen him like this before. He was always so cool, holding himself in check with his feelings packed out of sight. He had been that way even after an hour entombed in a pitch-black pit. Yet now, he was as white as a sheet. "Do you mind if I come in?" he said. "Of course not," I answered. "We're almost through with lunch, so do come in." "I really don't want to interrupt your meal," he said, glancing at his watch in what seemed a reflex motion. He stared at it for a long time, his face blank, as if he had a quarrel with how the second hand was moving. "We'll be done soon," I said again. "It's a very basic meal. Let's have coffee together afterward. Please wait in the living room. I'll make the introductions there." Manshiki shook his head. "Introductions might be premature at this stage. I stopped by assuming they'd already left. I wasn't planning to meet them. But I saw an unfamiliar car parked in front and wasn't sure what to do, so I..."
"You came at the perfect time," I said, cutting him off. "Nothing could be more natural. Just leave everything to me."
Manshiki nodded and began to take off his shoes, yet for some reason he seemed to have forgotten how. I waited until he had struggled through the procedure and showed him into the living room. He'd been there several times before, yet he stared at the room as though it was his first visit. "Please wait here," I said, patting him on the shoulder. "Just sit down and relax. It shouldn't take more than 10 minutes. I left Manshiki sitting there by himself, though it worried me a bit, and went back to the dining area. Choco and Maria had finished their meal in my absence. Their forks rested on empty plates.
"Do you have a visitor?" Choco asked in a worried voice.
"Yes, but it's all right. Someone from the neighborhood just happened to stop by. I asked him to wait in the living room. We're on friendly terms, so there's no need for formality. I'll just finish my meal first." I ate what remained of my lunch, then I brewed a pot of coffee while the two women cleaned up the dishes.
Shall we have our coffee in the living room? I asked Shoko. But won't we be intruding on you and your guest? I shook my head no. Not in the slightest. It's a stroke of luck. This way I can introduce you to each other. He lives on top of the slope on the other side of the valley, so I doubt you've ever met. What is his name?
Menshiki. It's written with the characters for avoidance and color. Avoiding colors, in other words.
What an unusual name, Shoko exclaimed. I've never heard anyone mention a Mr. Menshiki before.
The addresses of people across the valley are close to ours, but there's little coming and going between the two sides. We placed the pot of coffee, 4 cups, and some milk and sugar on a tray and carried it out to the living room. To my surprise, Menshiki was nowhere to be seen. The room was deserted. He wasn't on the terrace either, and I doubted he was in the bathroom. Where did he disappear to? I said to no one in particular.
Was he here earlier? Shoko asked.
Until a few minutes ago.
His suede shoes were gone from the entranceway. I slipped on my sandals and opened the front door. The silver Jaguar was parked exactly where he had left it, so he hadn't returned home. The sun reflecting off the Jaguar's windows made it impossible to tell if anyone was inside. I walked over to check. Menshiki was sitting in the driver's seat, rummaging around for something. I tapped on the window and he rolled it down. He looked lost.
What happened? I asked.
I want to check the air pressure in my tires, but I can't find the gauge. It should be in the glove compartment, but it's gone.
Is there some kind of rush?
No, not really. I was sitting there in your living room when it started to bother me. Couldn't recall the last time I checked.
So there's no trouble with them?
No, nothing in particular. They seem normal.
Then why don't you forget about the tires for now and come back in? The coffee is made and 2 people are waiting.
Waiting for me? He said in a hoarse voice. Are they waiting for me?
Yes, I told them I'd introduce you.
Oh dear, he said.
Why oh dear?
Because I'm not ready for introductions yet. Not emotionally prepared.
He had the baffled, fearful look of someone ordered to jump from the 16th floor of a burning building to a net that looked the size of a drink coaster.
You should come, I said, not mincing words. It's really not a big deal.
Menshiki nodded and got out, closing the car door behind him. He started to lock it before realizing how unnecessary that was. What thief would stray up here? So he stuffed the key in the pocket of his chinos. Shoko and Maria were waiting in the living room. They rose to greet us as we entered. My introductions were simple and straightforward, a common human courtesy.
Mr. Menshiki has also modeled for me. I painted his portrait. He happens to live nearby and we've been friends since we met.
I understand you live on the other side of the valley. Have you been there long? Shoko inquired.
Menshiki blanched at the mention of his home.
Yes, I've been living there for a few years. Let's see, how many is it now? 3 years, perhaps? Or is it 4?
He turned to me as if for confirmation, but I didn't respond.
Can we see your home from here? Shoko asked.
Yes, Menshiki said, but it's really nothing to brag about, he added. It's awfully out of the way.
It's the same on this side, Shoko said affably. Simple shopping is a major expedition. Cell phone service and radios are hit or miss, and the road is terribly steep. When the snow is thick, it gets so slippery I'm afraid to take the car out. Luckily, it doesn't happen that often. Just once, 5 years ago.
You're right, Menshiki said. It rarely snows here. It has to do with the warmth of the wind coming off the ocean. The ocean exerts a powerful influence on our climate. You see...
In any case, I broke in, we should be thankful it snows so rarely here.
I feared he was about to launch into a lecture on the structure and effects of the warm sea currents along the coast of Japan. That's how wound up he was. Maria was looking back and forth at her aunt and Menshiki throughout this exchange. She seemed to have formed no opinion about Menshiki as of yet. Menshiki, for his part, acted as though Maria wasn't there, focusing on her aunt as though bewitched. "Maria here is letting me paint her portrait," I said to him. "I asked her to model for me." "I drive her here every Sunday morning," Shoko said. "It's not far as the crow flies, from your eyes to your nose, you might say, but the road twists and turns so much we have to take the car." Menshiki finally turned to look at Maria Akikawa, but his eyes didn't focus on any part of her face. They buzzed about nervously, like a fly in winter, searching for a place to land, yet they never seemed to find one. "These are what I've drawn so far," I said, coming to his aid. I handed him my sketchbook. "I haven't started painting yet. We've just wrapped up the preliminary stage." Menshiki stared at the three Dasan for a long time, devouring them with his eyes, as if the drawings of Maria somehow meant more to him than Maria herself. This wasn't true, of course. He simply couldn't bring himself to face her. The Dasan were a substitute, nothing more. It was the first time he had been close to her, and he was having a hard time controlling his feelings. Maria, for her part, regarded the floundering Menshiki as though he were some kind of strange animal. "They're superb," Menshiki said. He turned to Shoko. "Each is so full of life. He's really captured her." "I totally agree," she said, beaming. "All the same, Maria is a very difficult subject," I said to Menshiki. "Painting her is a challenge. Her expression is constantly changing, so it takes time to grasp what's at the core. That's why I haven't gotten around to the actual painting stage yet." "Difficult?" Menshiki said. He looked at Maria a second time, squinting as though dazzled by her light. "The three Dasan should show very different expressions," I said. "The slightest facial movement radically transforms the whole atmosphere. When I paint her portrait, I have to get past those superficial differences to grasp the essence of her personality. Otherwise, I'd be conveying only part of the whole." "I see," Menshiki said, dutifully impressed. He looked back and forth between the three sketches and Maria, comparing them. In the process, his face, which had been so pale, began to regain some of its color. Red dots popped up at first, then the dots grew to blotches the size of ping-pong balls, then baseballs, until in the end, his whole face had turned rosy. Maria watched him, fascinated, but her aunt politely turned away. I grabbed the coffee pot and poured myself another cup. I felt I had to break the silence. "I'm thinking of starting the actual portrait next week. You know, on canvas with real paint," I said to no one in particular. "Do you have a clear image what it will look like?" asked Shoko. "Not yet," I said, shaking my head. "I won't know in any concrete way until I'm sitting in front of the canvas with a brush in my hand. Hopefully the inspiration will hit me then."
"You painted Mr. Menshiki's picture as well, didn't you?" Shoko asked me.
"Yes, last month."
"It's a beautiful portrait," Menshiki said emphatically. "The paint has to dry a bit more before it can be framed, but it's hanging on the wall of my study. I'm not sure portrait does it justice, though. It's a painting of me, but of something other than me, too. I don't know how to put it. I guess you could say it has depth. I never get tired of looking at it."
"You say it's you, yet it's not you at the same time?" Shoko asked.
"I mean, it's a step beyond your typical portrait. It's deeper, more profound."
"I want to see it," Maria said. They were the first words she had spoken since we had moved to the living room. But Maria, you shouldn't invite yourself into someone's...
That's perfectly all right, Menshiki said, cutting off her aunt's rebuke as if with a sharp hatchet.
His tone was so jarring that we all, including Menshiki himself, were stunned.
Please, do come take a look, he continued after a moment's regrouping. It's so rare for me to meet someone from the neighborhood. I live alone, so you needn't worry about disturbing anyone. Any time at all would be fine.
Menshiki's face was even redder by the time he finished. It appeared that we hadn't been the only ones shocked by the urgency in his voice.
Do you like paintings? Menshiki asked, this time directing his question to Maria.
His voice was back to normal. Maria gave a small nod.
If it's all right with you, why don't I stop by again at this time next Sunday? Menshiki said. I could escort you to my home, and we could all look at the painting together.
But we shouldn't inconvenience you, Shoko said.
I want to see the painting!
Maria was firm. In the end, it was agreed that Menshiki would come to pick up the two of them the following Sunday afternoon. I was invited too, but I declined, citing an important errand. The last thing I wanted was to get sucked in any deeper. From now on, let those who are involved look after things. I would remain the outsider, however the situation turned out. I would be the mediator, nothing more, though even that had not been my intention. Menshiki and I accompanied the beautiful aunt and her niece outside to give them a proper send-off. Shoko looked for some time at the silver jaguar parked next to her Prius, like a dog lover appraising another person's dog.
This is the latest model, isn't it? She asked Menshiki.
Yes, this is their newest coupe on the market, he answered. Do you like cars?
No, it's not that. It's just that my late father drove a Jaguar sedan. I used to sit next to him, and every so often he'd let me hold the wheel. The Jaguar hood ornament takes me back to those times. Was it an XJ6? It had four round headlights, I think, and an inline six-cylinder 4.2-liter engine.
That is the 3 Series, I believe. A truly beautiful model.
My father drove that car for ages, so he must have really liked it, although he complained about the terrible mileage, and it had one minor malfunction after the other.
That model in particular is a real gas guzzler, and the wiring was probably faulty. The electrical system has always been the Jaguar's Achilles heel, but if it's running smoothly and if you don't mind shelling out for gas, you can't beat a Jaguar. For driving, comfort, and handling, no other car matches it. It's got a charm all its own. Most people, though, are really turned off by things like gas consumption and mechanical glitches, which is why the Toyota Prius is the one flying off the lots.
I didn't buy this car, Shoko said, as if by way of apology, gesturing toward her Prius. My brother bought it for me because it's safe and easy to drive, and gentle on the environment.
The Prius is an excellent car, Menshiki said. I've thought of buying one myself.
Was he kidding? Menshiki behind the wheel of a Toyota Prius was as hard to picture as a leopard ordering a salade niçoise.
This is very rude of me, Shoko said, peering into the Jaguar's interior. But would it be all right if I sat in it for a minute? I just want to try out the driver's seat.
Of course, Menshiki answered.
He coughed lightly, as if to bring his voice under control.
Sit there as long as you like. Take it for a spin if you wish.
I was flabbergasted by how interested she was in Menshiki's Jaguar. On the surface, she was so cool and poised, not my image of a car person at all, yet her eyes were shining when she climbed into the driver's seat. She snuggled into the cream-colored leather upholstery, studied the dashboard with care, and took the steering wheel in both hands. Then she placed her left hand on the gear shift.
Menshiki took the car key from his pocket and passed it to her through the window.
Turn it on if you like.
Shoko took the key, inserted it into the ignition next to the wheel, and rotated it clockwise. Instantly, the great feline awoke. She sat there entranced for a moment, listening to the deep purr of the engine.
I remember this sound well, she said.
It's a 4.2-liter V8 engine. Your father's XJ6 had 6 cylinders, and the number of valves and the compression ratio were different too, but they may well sound alike. Both are sinful, though. They squander fossil fuel like there's no tomorrow. Jaguars haven't changed a bit on that score.
Shoko flipped on the right turn signal. I heard a cheerful clicking sound.
This really brings back memories.
Menshiki smiled.
Only a Jaguar's turn signal sounds like this. It's unlike that of any other automobile.
When I was young, I secretly practiced on the XJ6 to get my driver's license, she said. The first time I drove another car, I was totally confused. The parking brake wasn't where I expected. I had no idea what to do.
I know just what you mean, Menshiki grinned. The Brits are fussy about the funniest things.
I think the interior smells a bit different than my father's car, though.
Sadly, you're right. For a variety of reasons, Jaguar can't use the exact same materials on its newer models. The smell changed after 2002, when Connolly Leather stopped supplying their upholstery. In fact, the Connolly Company went out of business at that point.
How too bad. I loved that smell. I connect it to the smell of my father.
To tell the truth, Menshiki said hesitantly, I own another Jaguar as well, an older model. It may well have the same odor as your father's car.
Is it an XJ6?
No, it's an E-Type.
Does that mean it's a convertible?
Correct. It's a Series 1 Roadster, made back in the mid-60s. It still runs well, though. It's also equipped with a 6-cylinder 4.2-liter engine, an original 2-seater. The top has been replaced, of course, so it's not exactly in mint condition.
Most of this flew over my head. I know nothing about cars, but Menshiki's words seemed to have made a deep impression on Shoko. They clearly shared an interest, and a fairly specialized interest at that, in Jaguars. That made me feel a little calmer. No longer did I have to think up topics to help them through their first meeting. Maria's boredom was palpable, though. She seemed even less into cars than me. Shoko got out of the Jaguar, shut the car door, and handed the key to Menshiki, who returned it to the pocket of his chinos. Then she and Maria got in the blue Prius. Menshiki closed the door after Maria. I was struck by the different thunk it made as it closed, nothing like the Jaguar. In this world, what we think of as a single sound can have so many permutations. Just as we know from one note struck on the open string of a double bass, whether it's Charlie Mingus or Ray Brown.
So we'll meet again next Sunday, Menshiki said.
Shoko gave Menshiki a big smile, took the steering wheel, and drove off. Menshiki and I waited until the squat rear of the Toyota Prius was out of sight before returning to the house. We sat in the living room, sipping cold coffee. Neither of us spoke for some time. Menshiki looked exhausted, like a long-distance runner who had just crossed the finish line. She's a beautiful girl, I said at last. Maria, I mean.
You're right. She'll be even prettier when she grows up, Menshiki said.
His mind seemed elsewhere.
What did you think, seeing her up close? I asked.
Menshiki smiled, an uncomfortable smile.
I didn't get a very good look, to tell the truth. I was too nervous.
But you must have seen something.
Of course, he said, nodding.
He paused for a long moment.
What did you think?
He asked at last, his eyes serious. What do you mean, what do I think?
Menshiki's face flushed again. Do you see any similarity between Maria's features and mine? As an artist who has painted people's portraits for many years, I'm interested in your professional opinion.
I shook my head, no. You're right, I'm trained to take quick note of people's facial characteristics, but that doesn't mean I can tell whose child is whose. Some parents and children don't look alike at all, while total strangers can appear almost identical.
Menshiki gave a long, deep sigh. It sounded wrenched from his entire body. He rubbed his palms together. I'm not asking for a definitive judgment. I'm just asking for your personal impressions, even the most trivial ones. I'd like to know if you noticed something, anything at all.
I thought for a moment. As far as facial structure goes, I don't see much concrete similarity. But your eyes do have something in common. In fact, it startles me every so often.
He looked at me, his thin lips pressed together. You're saying there's something similar in our eyes?
Maybe it's because they reflect your true feelings. Curiosity, enthusiasm, surprise, suspicion, reluctance. I can see those subtle emotions in both your eyes and hers. Your faces aren't all that expressive, but your eyes really are the windows to your hearts. Most people are the opposite. Their faces are expressive, but their eyes aren't nearly so lively.
Menshiki appeared surprised. Is that how my eyes look to you?
I nodded.
I was never aware of that.
You couldn't control it if you tried. Maybe it's because your feelings are on such a tight leash that your eyes are so expressive. It's not that obvious, though. You have to pay really, really close attention to read them. Most people wouldn't notice.
But you can.
Reading faces is my profession. Menshiki considered that for a minute.
So she and I have that in common. But you still can't tell if we're father and daughter, right?
I do have certain impressions when I look at people, and I value those. But artistic impressions and objective reality are separate things. Impressions don't prove anything. They're like a butterfly in the wind, totally useless. But how about you? Did you feel anything special?
He shook his head several times. I couldn't tell anything in one brief meeting. I need to see her more. I have to get used to being around her first.
He shook his head again, this time more slowly. He plunged his hands into his jacket pockets as though searching for something, then pulled them out again, as though he'd forgotten what he was looking for.
No, maybe it's not the number of times, he went on. It could be the more we meet, the more confused I'll get, the farther from any conclusion. It's possible she's my daughter, but then it's possible she isn't. But either way makes no difference to me. Her presence alone allows me to consider that possibility, to physically experience that hypothesis. When that happens, I feel fresh blood coursing through my body. Maybe I've never understood the true meaning of being alive until now.
I held my peace. What could I say about the feelings he was experiencing or about his definition of being alive? Menshiki glanced at his thin, expensive-looking wristwatch and awkwardly struggled to his feet from the sofa.
I owe you my thanks. I couldn't have done a thing if you hadn't given me a push.
With these few words, he stumbled toward the door, struggled a bit to put on his shoes, and stepped outside. From the door, I watched him climb in his car and drive away. When his Jaguar was out of sight, the peaceful quiet of a Sunday afternoon enfolded me once again. The clock said a little after 2 p.m. I was dead tired. I pulled an old blanket from the closet, lay on the sofa, and slept with it tucked over me. It was past 3 when I awoke. The angle of the sunlight in the room had shifted somewhat. What a strange day. I couldn't be sure if I had moved forward or fallen behind, or if I was just circling over the same spot. My sense of direction had gone haywire. There was Shoko and Maria, and then there was Menshiki. Each had a special magnetism, and I had landed smack in the middle of it all, lacking any magnetism of my own to speak of. However exhausted I might feel, though, Sunday was far from over. The hands of the clock had only just passed 3. The sun was still in the sky. Loads of time remained before a new day dawned and Sunday became a thing of the past. Yet I didn't feel like doing anything. I had taken a nap, but my head was muddled. It felt like a ball of yarn had been crammed into the back of a narrow desk drawer, and now the drawer wouldn't close properly. Maybe this was the sort of day I should check the air pressure in my tires. Anyone feeling this blah should be able to rouse himself to do that much. Come to think of it, though, I had never checked the air pressure myself. Whenever a gas station attendant said that the air in my tires looked a little low, I always asked him to take care of it, which means I don't own an air pressure gauge. In fact, I don't even know what one looks like. If it fits in a glove compartment, it can't be all that big, nor so expensive as to require monthly payments. Maybe I should buy one, just to see. When it began to get dark, I went to the kitchen, cracked open a can of beer, and began preparing dinner. In the oven, I broiled a piece of yellowtail that I'd marinated in sake lees, then sliced pickles, made a cucumber and seaweed salad with vinegar, and fixed some miso soup with radishes and deep-fried tofu. Then I sat down and ate my silent meal. There was no one there to talk to, and nothing in particular I could think of to talk about. Just when I was finishing my simple, solitary dinner, the front doorbell rang. There seemed to be a conspiracy afoot to interrupt me toward the end of every meal. So this day hasn't ended after all, I thought. I had the premonition it would be a long Sunday. I got up from the table and walked slowly to the door. Chapter 35. You should have just left that place alone. I walked slowly to the door. Who could possibly be ringing the bell? Had a car pulled up in front without my knowledge? The dining area was toward the rear of the house, but it was a quiet night, so I should have heard the crunch of gravel and the rumble of an engine. Even the vaunted, silent hybrid engine of a Prius. Still, my ears had picked up nothing. No one would climb such a long, steep slope on foot at night on a lark. The road was unlit and deserted. My house had been plopped down on top of an isolated mountain with no neighbors close by. For a moment, I thought it might be the Commendatore, but that didn't make much sense. I mean, he could come and go whenever he wanted, so why ring the bell? I unlocked and opened the door without bothering to check who it was. Maria Akikawa was standing there. She was wearing the same clothes she had worn that afternoon, only now a thin navy blue down jacket covered her windbreaker. Naturally, it got chillier once the sun was down. She had a Cleveland Indians cap on her head. Why Cleveland? And a large flashlight in her right hand. "Can I come in?" she asked. There was no good evening, no sorry for the surprise visit. "Sure," I said. "Come on in." That was it. My mental desk drawer wasn't closing properly yet. That ball of yarn was still jammed in there. I showed her into the dining room. "I'm still eating dinner. Mind if I finish?" I said. She nodded silently. She was free of all the tiresome social graces. They meant nothing to her. "Want some tea?" I asked. She nodded again. She took off her down jacket, removed her cap, and straightened her hair. I set the kettle to boil and put some green tea in a small teapot. I wanted a cup of tea myself. With her elbows on the table, Mario watched me polish off the broiled yellowtail, miso soup, and salad as if she had come across something very strange. She could have been sitting on a rock in the jungle watching a python swallow a baby badger. I marinated the yellowtail myself, I explained, breaking the silence. It keeps a lot longer that way. She didn't respond. I couldn't tell if my words had reached her or not. Immanuel Kant was a man of punctual habits, I said, so punctual that people set their clocks by when he passed on his strolls. Absolutely meaningless, of course. I just wanted to see how she'd react to something so totally random, if she was really listening or not. Again, no response. The silence around us only deepened further. Immanuel Kant continued strolling through the streets of Königsberg, leading his regulated and taciturn life. His last words were, "This is good. Es ist gut." Some people can live like that. I finished dinner and carried the dishes to the sink. Then I made tea. I returned with the teapot and two cups. Maria sat there at the table watching me throughout. She was eyeballing me intently, like a historian meticulously checking the footnotes of a text. "You didn't come by car, did you?" I asked. At last, she opened her mouth. "I walked," she said.
"All the way from your house? By yourself?"
"Uh-huh."
I waited for her to go on, but she didn't. We sat there across from each other at the table for a while without speaking. I'm pretty good at long silences, though. No accident I'm holed up by myself on top of a mountain.
"There's a secret passageway," Maria said at last. "It's a long way by car, but not far if you take the passageway."
"I've walked all over this area, but I've never seen anything like that."
"You don't know how to look," she shot back. "You really have to pay attention to find it. It's well hidden."
"You hid it, right?"
She nodded. "I've lived here since I was small. The whole mountain is my playground. I know every part of it."
"So the passageway is really well concealed."
She gave another firm nod.
"And you used it to come here."
"Uh-huh."
I sighed. "Have you had dinner?"
"I ate already."
"What did you eat?"
"My aunt isn't a very good cook," the girl said.
Not a real answer to my question. It was clear she wanted to let the matter drop. Maybe she didn't want to recall what she'd eaten for dinner. "Does your aunt know you came here by yourself?"
Maria didn't reply. Her lips were set in a straight line.
I chose to answer my own question. "Of course she doesn't. What responsible adult would let a 13-year-old girl wander the mountains after dark, right?"
There followed another period of silence.
"She's not aware of the passageway?"
Maria shook her head several times. "So her aunt didn't know."
"And you're the only one who knows about it?"
Maria nodded several times.
"In any event," I said, "given where you live, once you left the passageway, you probably went through the woods and past an old shrine to get here, right?"
Maria nodded again. "I know that shrine, and I know that someone used a big machine to dig up the pile of rocks behind it."
"Did you watch?"
Maria shook her head. "I didn't see them digging. I was at school that day, but I saw the tracks. The ground was covered with them. Why did you do it?"
"I had reasons."
"What kind of reasons?"
"If I tried to explain from the beginning, it would take too long," I said. So I didn't try. The last thing I wanted was for her to find out that Menshiki was involved.
"It was wrong to dig it up like that," Maria said abruptly.
"Why do you say that?"
She gave what looked like a shrug. "You should have just left that place alone. Everyone else did."
"Everyone else?"
It's been there like forever, but no one touched it until now.
The girl was right, I thought. Perhaps we shouldn't have touched it. Perhaps we should have behaved like everyone else had. It was too late to change that now, though. The stones had been moved, the pit exposed, the commendatore set free.
Were you the one who removed the lid? I asked.
Let me guess. You looked inside, then you replaced the boards and the stones that held them down. Am I right?
Maria raised her head and looked me straight in the eye, as if to say, how did you know?
The rocks on the lid had been rearranged. My visual memory is pretty good, always has been. I could see the difference right away.
Wow, she murmured, impressed.
But the hole was empty. Nothing but darkness and damp air, right?
A ladder was there too.
You didn't climb down it, did you?
Maria shook her head vigorously, as if to say, no way.
And now, I said, you've come here at this time of night for a particular reason, haven't you? I mean, this isn't just a social visit, is it?
A social visit?
You know, and I happened to be in the neighborhood, so I thought I'd stop by kind of thing.
She thought for a moment before shaking her head. No, it's not a social visit.
Then what is it? I asked. I'm more than happy to have you visit me, but if your aunt or your father found out, it could lead to a bizarre misunderstanding.
What kind of misunderstanding?
There are all sorts of misunderstandings in this world, I said. Some go far beyond what you and I can imagine. In this case, it could make it impossible for me to paint your portrait. That would bother me a lot. Wouldn't it bother you?
My aunt won't find out, she said emphatically. I go to my room after dinner and she never follows me. It's like an agreement we have. I leave through my window and no one knows. No one's ever caught on.
So you've been walking the mountain at night for a long time?
Maria nodded.
Isn't it scary all by yourself after dark?
Other things are a lot scarier.
Like what, for example?
Maria shrugged her shoulders slightly but said nothing.
Your aunt may not be a problem, but how about your father?
He's not back yet.
Even though today's Sunday?
Maria didn't answer. I guessed she wanted to avoid talking about her father. Anyway, you don't have to worry, she said. No one knows when I leave the house. Even if they found out, I'd never give your name.
All right then, I'll stop worrying, I said. But why did you come here tonight, of all nights?
Because I wanted to talk to you about something.
Like what?
Maria picked up her cup and took a sip of hot tea. She looked warily around the room as if to make sure no one would overhear. Of course, nobody was there but the two of us. That is, unless the commendatore had returned and was listening in. I looked around as well, but the commendatore wasn't there. If he was, he hadn't assumed bodily form. Your friend who showed up this afternoon, the guy with the pretty white hair, she said. What was his name? It was kind of weird.
Menshiki.
That's right, Mr. Menshiki.
He's not really a friend. I met him just a short while ago.
Whatever.
So what is it about Mr. Menshiki?
She narrowed her eyes and looked at me. I think, she said, lowering her voice, that man is hiding something in his heart.
What sort of thing?
I don't know, but I don't believe he showed up this afternoon by accident like he said. I think he came for a very specific purpose.
What purpose is that? I asked, a little shocked by how observant she was. She fixed me with her gaze.
I'm not sure. Don't you know?
I have no idea, I lied, praying that Maria wouldn't see through my deception. I have never been a good liar. When I lie, it's written on my face. But there is no way I could tell her the truth.
For real?
For real, I said. I had no idea he would show up today.
Maria seemed to buy my story. Menshiki had not told me he would be coming, and his sudden visit had taken me by surprise, so I wasn't really lying after all.
His eyes are weird, Maria said.
Weird in what way?
It's like he's always scheming about something, like the wolf in Little Red Riding Hood. When the wolf dresses up like the grandmother and lies in bed, you can tell it's him by his eyes.
Like the wolf in Little Red Riding Hood?
So you had an adverse reaction to Mr. Menshiki, right?
Adverse reaction?
A negative impression. A feeling he might harm you.
Adverse reaction, she said. She seemed to be storing the phrase in her mental filing cabinet, alongside a bolt from the blue, no doubt.
It's not like that, Maria said. I don't think he's planning anything bad. I just think Mr. Menshiki with the pretty white hair is hiding something.
And you sense it, right?
Maria nodded.
That's why I came to see you. I thought you might be able to tell me more about him.
Does your aunt feel the same way? I asked, trying to deflect her question.
No, she answered, tilting her head to one side. That's not what she's like. She seldom has an adverse reaction to people, and I think she's interested in him. He's a bit older, but he's handsome and well-dressed and, I guess, very rich and living all by himself.
So you think she's taken to him?
I guess so. She really lit up when she talked to him. Her face and her voice, it got higher. She wasn't like usual. I bet he felt the change too.
I said nothing, just poured us both a fresh cup of tea. I took a sip. Maria seemed to be turning something over in her mind.
I wonder, how did he know we were going to be here today? She asked. Did you tell him?
I don't think Mr. Menshiki came planning to meet your aunt. I chose my words with care, hoping to avoid another lie. In fact, he tried to leave when he realized the two of you were here, but I talked him into staying. He happened to stop by when your aunt happened to be here, and when he saw her, he got interested. Your aunt is a very attractive woman, you know.
Maria didn't look entirely convinced, but she didn't push the issue any further. She just sat there frowning, elbows on the table.
In any case, the two of you are going to visit his home next Sunday, I said.
Maria nodded. Yes, to see your portrait of him. My aunt seems to be really looking forward to it. To paying Mr. Menshiki a visit, I mean.
I don't blame her for getting excited, I said. After all, she's living in the mountains with no other people around. Not like in the city where she'd have opportunities to meet all sorts of men.
Maria pressed her lips together for a moment. My aunt used to have a boyfriend, she said, as if letting me in on a big secret. A man she saw for a really long time, when she was a secretary in Tokyo. But a lot of things happened, and in the end they broke up. It hurt her a lot. Then my mother died and she came to look after me. She didn't tell me any of this, of course.
I don't think she's seeing anyone now, is she?
Maria shook her head. I don't think so.
So you're a little concerned that your aunt is interested in Mr. Menshiki, and that she may be experiencing the first stirrings of something. So you came to talk to me about it. Is that right?
Tell me, do you think he's trying to seduce her?
Seduce her?
I mean, that he isn't serious?
There's no way for me to tell, I said. I don't know Mr. Menshiki that well. They just met this afternoon, so nothing has happened between them yet. When two people's feelings are involved like this, things can change in subtle ways. What begins as a small feeling can grow into something really big, or the opposite can happen.
But I have a kind of hunch this time, she asserted.
I sensed that I should believe her kind of hunch, baseless though it was, for I had a similar kind of hunch. So you're worried something could occur that might harm your aunt psychologically, I said. Maria gave a quick nod.
My aunt's not a very cautious person, and she's not used to being hurt.
It sounds like you're the one looking after her, and not the other way around, I said.
In a way,
Maria said seriously. How about you, then? Are you used to being hurt?
I don't know, Maria said. At least I'm not about to fall in love.
You will someday, though.
But not now. Not until my chest gets a little bigger, anyway.
That may happen sooner than you expect. Maria made a wry face. I guessed she didn't believe me.
I felt a seed of doubt sprout in my own chest. Would Menshiki draw close to Shoko Akikawa to establish a firm connection with Maria?
After all, he had said to me, I couldn't tell anything in one brief meeting. I need to see her more. Shoko would be an important intermediary. Through her, Menshiki could see Maria on a regular basis. After all, she was the one looking after the girl. To a greater or lesser extent, therefore, Menshiki had to place Shoko under his thumb. That shouldn't be too hard for a man of Menshiki's talents. Not child's play, perhaps, but close to it. I didn't like to think that Menshiki was harboring a plan of that sort. Yet perhaps the Commendatore had been right, and he was a man who couldn't help fabricating some scheme or other. From what I had seen, however, he wasn't that cunning.
Mr. Menshiki's house is really impressive, I said to Maria. You may or may not like it, but it wouldn't hurt to take a look.
Have you been there?
Only once. I went there for dinner.
It's on the other side of the valley?
Right across from us.
Can you see it from here?
I pretended to think for a moment.
Yes, but it's far away, of course.
Show me.
I led her to the terrace and pointed out Menshiki's mansion on top of the mountain across the valley. Bathed in the light from the garden lanterns, the building floated white in the distance like an elegant ocean liner sailing the night sea. Several of the windows were also lit up. The lights burning there were small and unobtrusive.
That enormous white house? Maria exclaimed in surprise.
She stared at me for a moment, then wordlessly she turned back to the distant mansion.
I can see it from my house, too, she said eventually. The angle's a bit different, though. I've always wondered who would live in a place like that.
It does stand out, that's for sure, I said. Anyway, that's Mr. Menshiki's home. Maria spent a long time leaning over the railing looking at the house. A handful of stars twinkled above its roof. There was no wind, and a small, sharp-edged cloud hung there motionless, like a paper cutout nailed to a plywood backdrop in a play. Each time the girl moved her head, her straight black hair glittered in the moonlight.
Does Mr. Menshiki really live there all by himself?
Maria asked, turning to me.
Yes, he does. All alone in that big house. And he's not married?
He told me he is never married.
What kind of work does he do?
I'm not sure. Something connected to the information business, he said. Maybe having to do with tech. He doesn't have a regular job right now, though. He lives on the money he made from selling his old business, and from stock dividends and so forth. I don't know the details.
So he doesn't work? Maria said, wrinkling her forehead.
That's what he said. Seldom leaves his home, apparently.
He might well be standing on his terrace, watching the two of us through his high-powered binoculars, just as we were watching him. What would run through his mind if he saw us standing side by side like this?
You'd better head home, I told Maria. It's getting late.
Besides asking about Mr. Menshiki, she said softly, as if confiding something, I wanted to tell you, I'm really happy that you're painting my picture. I can't wait to see it.
I hope it turns out well, I said. Her words moved me more than a little. It was strange how much this girl opened up when painting was involved. I walked her to the door. Maria put on her tight-fitting down jacket and crammed her Indian's cap down over her head. Now she looked like a boy. "Shall I walk with you partway?" I asked. "I'm fine. I know the path." "See you next Sunday, then." But instead of leaving, she paused for a moment with her hand on the door frame. "One thing bothers me," she said. "It's that bell."
"The bell?"
"I thought I heard it ringing on my way here. The same kind of jingling sound that the bell in your studio made." I was at a loss for words. Maria's eyes were on my face. "Where was it exactly?" I asked. "In the woods. It came from behind the shrine." I listened to the dark, but I heard no bell. I heard no sound at all, just the quiet of the night. "Weren't you scared?" I asked. Maria shook her head. "If I leave it alone, there's nothing to be scared of." "Wait here just a second," I told Maria. I ran back to the studio. The bell was not where I had left it. It had vanished from the shelf. Chapter 36. What I want is not to have to discuss the rules of the game. After seeing Maria off, I went into the studio, turned on all the lights, and combed every inch of the room. But the old bell was nowhere to be found. It had vanished from sight. When had I last seen it? The previous Sunday, on her first visit, Maria had taken the bell down and shaken it. Then she had returned it to the shelf. I remembered that. But had I laid eyes on the bell since? I couldn't recall. I had hardly set foot in the studio all week. Not once had I picked up my brush. The man with the white Subaru Forester had stalled, and I hadn't yet started Maria's portrait. I was what you might call between paintings. Then, without my knowledge, the bell had disappeared. But Maria had heard it ringing behind the shrine when she passed through the woods. Could someone have returned it to the pit? Should I rush there now, see if I could hear the bell with my own ears? Yet the prospect of hurrying off into the dark woods alone didn't appeal to me. Too many surprises in one day had worn me out. Whatever one might say, I had more than filled my quota of unforeseen events. I went into the kitchen, pulled out the ice tray, plunked a few cubes in a glass, and doused them with whiskey. It was only 8:30. Had Maria safely navigated the woods and returned home through her passageway? I felt sure she had. No need for me to worry. This mountain had been her playground since she was small, she had said, and she was a lot tougher than she looked. I took my time working my way through two glasses of scotch, munched a few crackers, brushed my teeth, and went to bed. For all I knew, I might be roused in the middle of the night by a ringing bell. Around 2 a.m. as before. Nothing much I could do about that. If it happened, I would deal with it then. But nothing happened. As far as I knew, anyway. I slept like a log until 6:30 the next morning. When I awoke, it was raining outside. A chilly rain, signaling the approach of winter. Quiet and persistent. It reminded me of the rain that had been falling that day in March when my wife announced that our marriage was over. I hadn't faced her as she spoke. For the most part, I had looked out the window at the rain. After breakfast, I put on my vinyl poncho and rain hat, both purchased on my trip at a sporting goods store in Hakodate, and walked into the woods. I didn't take an umbrella. I circled the shrine and removed half the boards covering the pit. I made a careful search with my flashlight, but it was empty. No bell, and no sign of the commendatore. Just to make sure, I decided to descend the metal ladder to check. I had never entered the pit before. The rungs sagged and gave an ominous creak with each